Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming. This is the first event in a new debate series which Tech Central is launching. We're going to be making it a quarterly event where we discuss important issues in the facing the ICT industry. And I want to thank you all, first of all, for coming this afternoon and to the high-level panelists who have joined us today to talk about broadband in South Africa and what the future holds. I'd just like to go through some administrative stuff before we get started. First of all, those who will be tweeting this afternoon, could I ask you please to use the TC Debate hashtag. Secondly, there is an audio stream going out this afternoon. You're welcome to pass that message on to people who are not here, who couldn't make it this afternoon. Thanks to Simon Dingle, the host of the ZA Tech Show, for organizing the audio this afternoon. If you haven't checked out the ZA Tech Show yet, please do so. It's at zatechshow.co.za. It's the country's leading weekly technology podcast. You can also follow the ZA Tech Show on Twitter at ZA Tech Show. An audio podcast of this event will also be made available on Tech Central tomorrow morning. I'd like to thank Internet Solutions for sponsoring the event on an exclusive basis. Without their support this afternoon, would not have been possible. It's also helped pay for the drinks bill, which the drinks after the event, which will take place in the Liquid Lounge just around the corner. So if you have time to stay, please do join us for a drink. That would be great. I'd also like to thank First National Bank for providing this room for us this afternoon. I think it's a really nice facility, and so thank you to F&B for that. I'd also like to thank Simone and her team at Headlines for organizing this afternoon and managing all of the administration. There's a lot of work that goes into organizing an event like this, so thanks very much, Simone. Just lastly, there will be extensive time for an audience Q&A this afternoon. I'll allow about 20 to 25 minutes for audience Q&A at the end, so if you could keep your questions until then, there should be plenty of time to get to most of them. Lastly, I'd just like to introduce the panel here today. On my immediate right, a man who I don't think needs a lot of introduction. He's been in this industry for a very long time, William Stuckey, who is now a CASA counselor. To his immediate right is Lars Reichholz. I was going to say the newly appointed CEO of Cell C, but I think he's been in the job for was about a year now, Lars. On Lars's right is Derek Wilcox, who is MD of Internet Solutions, the country's largest integrated service provider. And to his right, sorry, I'm having to say, we have Stefano Mattiello, who is head of enterprise sales. Is that right, Matt?
Almost.
Okay. at Neotel, the second network operator. And right at the end, we have Jean Fisser, the CEO of AfriHost, who effectively started the price war in the broadband price war in ADSL last year. Thanks very much for joining today's discussion. I think we've seen a lot of activity in the broadband market in South Africa over the last 6 months or so, particularly in the fixed line market, where we've seen bandwidth costs drop substantially. As I mentioned, AfriHost probably kicked it off, but we've seen a lot of activity with bandwidth prices falling from the region of 50 to 70 rand a gigabyte 18 months ago, then right down to below 10 rand a gigabyte today on some packages. We've also seen some activity, although not quite as dramatic, in the mobile space with the likes of Vodacom and MTN introducing new packages, and Cell C planning to build out a broadband network for the first time. So lots of exciting things happening in that regard. I think we've still got a long way to go, though. Particularly, perhaps, if we look at what's happening in the fixed line market and access to broadband communication generally. Someone was pointing out to me yesterday that fixed line penetration in South Africa is still sitting at around 8%, and ADSL sitting on those telecom lines is only a fraction of that again. So penetration in terms of broadband and the fixed line is very low indeed. I'd like to spend some time perhaps exploring with the panelists here today what we might be able to do to increase that penetration in the fixed line space. And perhaps ask the question as well, is that where we should be focusing? Should we be focusing on fixed lines and rolling out new fiber and that sort of thing? Or should we be leaving that behind and focusing on wireless as our future in South Africa, given that the fixed line infrastructure isn't particularly well developed? I'd like to start by asking William Stuckey from ICASA to kind of talk a little bit about, from a regulatory perspective, talk a little bit about the state of broadband penetration in South Africa, how you see the market at the moment, where ICASA would like to see it going over the next couple of years, and perhaps talk a little bit about the role of wireless and fixed line in doing that.
Can I start by giving some background?
Sure.
Connectivity problem is divided into five different areas. Firstly, there's international connectivity appearing, for example, London. That's a sorted problem. It's fully competitive, very cheap, and there's no problem at all. Secondly, there's the cost of, or the problem of getting connectivity from Europe or elsewhere to South Africa, and that's typically done with a submarine cable. Until quite recently, we had only SAT-3. We've now got Seacom operating. So that is a, and several others coming, that is a problem which is almost solved. The costs have come down dramatically. You're looking at, on CCOM, your total cost, if you only buy an SDN1, is about 7,000 megabit per second, coming down to about 2.5 if you buy an SDN64. SDN64 is 10 gigabits per second, about 10 it has, although they pay a lot less for it than that. And the SDN1 is 135 gigabits per second, which gives around 50 megs of capacity. So having got traffic to South African shores, you then got to distribute it around South Africa. And for that, you need a national backbone network. And that's where our first problem starts. Only one organization has a network that reaches not just 150 largest towns, which is about 20,000 kilometers wide, but all the towns in South Africa, and that's Telkom. Others are busy doing it. It's on my right, that are doing it. There's a joint venture between Airtel, Vodacom, and MTN doing it. Samuel are doing it. Infraco has got a significant amount of fiber, 12,000 kilometers. But none of them have anything near the 20-plus thousand kilometers you require to cover the major cities, the major towns, if that is the towns of more than 10,000 kilometers. So, although that problem is not yet solved, it is becoming solved, insofar as all those parties that I mentioned are busy laying fiber and then fiber. And I would expect that within a few years we will see that ceasing to be a problem. But 20 or 30,000 kilometers of fiber is a significant investment. The fourth part of the problem is metropolitan networks. Neotel is laying fiber in Johannesburg and other cities, so is DFA, so is MTN, so is Vodacom, so are the cities themselves. But we still are far from covering, providing the relative against grid connectivity required within each of our major cities in order to provide connectivity. So that's a problem which is not going to be solved for significantly longer. Once again, the only organization that has a substantial network. Finally, we come to the last mile. And then we have a stop. We have, in terms of fixed line connectivity, there is only one player in the market. In terms of the scale of the cost of how much it costs you to build these different networks, you can say that the metropolitan network is probably about twice the cost of the national backbone network. Last mile, twice again. So we need substantial investment in South Africa in order to provide what I see as our end objective, which is fiber to my house and yours.
William, can we do that through private capital, or does the government need to be involved?
Either. Private capital will most likely be the most likely successful way for it to happen. Certainly some of it is happening through various levels of government. For example, the municipal networks are some of the metros of councils are voting on. That's local government money. Although some of them are, in fact, not actually doing it themselves, they're employing someone else to do it for them. The issue really is a question of the perception, is there a business case? Until about 5 years ago, there was the perception that there is no business case for additional sovereignty fiber to South Africa. And if I know my trumpet slightly, I was a member of an organization which funded from all over Africa and the rest of the world the fact that in South Africa and Africa generally, we did not, it wasn't that we had a low demand for bandwidth, it's just the prices were high. And SAP3 was operated on a high price, low volume model. CTOM's come in on the opposite model, the high volume, low price model. And what changed is effectively the perceptions of investors that A, demand exists, and B, the demand is elastic. In other words, if not just if you build it, they will come, but if you build it and price it low enough, they will buy lots. And we need to, the investors need to convince themselves that that is the situation for rolling out the metropolitan and last mile networks. However, I must give a word of caution. Currently, our first and second national operators are charging more or less the same for fixed line connectivity. There are differences, but they're not substantial. If you are to build a business plan for rolling out national, metropolitan, or last mile connectivity, do not assume that you will be able to charge the same prices as you're currently being charged, because the real cost is somewhere between 3% and 7% of what's currently being charged. So you can build a network and you can sell it for a fraction of what's going to happen now. So if you build a business plan, what's happening is if you build a business plan based on current prices, you are going to be unhappy. When investors have the courage to invest those many billions, we're talking many billions here, and to build those kind of networks, then you'll see a dramatic change in South Africa. And that is something that has happened elsewhere in the world. It's in Australia, they're doing it with the government-backed thing. In the US, they're doing it with France. In the Far East, they're doing it with a number of countries, both private and government-owned. It's happening elsewhere, and it's working. It is not a trivial exercise. It's not a cheap exercise, but it is worth it.
Matt, perhaps I could jump over to you. Neotel has obviously been doing some investment both in national fiber and fiber to the curb and other initiatives in South Africa. Can I ask your views on fiber into business premises and also fiber into the home and whether we're going to see that in South Africa and whether the business case for that actually makes sense?
To answer the question, are we going to see it? Of course we're going to see it. To a large extent, we've seen that already. I think it's really just a case of, is the business case appropriate at what point in time? Going back to what William was saying, 5 years ago there was no business case for a mellow submarine cable. Today we're talking about potentially 4 submarine cables in South Africa. So it's very much a case of, as the market evolves, do you have the infrastructure in place to address that market? I'll give you an example. When we launched our services about 2.5 years ago, we took a decision to build an IP fiber-based network. The market at the time was not buying IP services, and they were buying, at best they were buying a 2 megabit connection, a V1 connection. Gambling, it was a big gamble to invest in an infrastructure that was capable of delivering a lot more capacity to what the market was buying then. Today, I'm pleased to say, we have customers that are buying hundreds of gigabits of capacity. So the market has evolved and it will continue to evolve. So it's really just a case of, do we have the infrastructure in place and is the market ready to accept the infrastructure now? I think one of the challenges that we have in South Africa is that the density is not as prevalent as it is in other parts of the world. So, for example, if you take, I've seen often being compared to Hong Kong and Singapore and these places where typically people will live in high-rise buildings. But the cost of connecting up a high-rise building and getting to that population is a lot less than it is in the South African environment, where you actually have a typical suburban environment where you have to dig up roads, you have to dig up pavements, and put the fiber in the ground to address that market.
So at what point does it become economically feasible to do this?
It's very difficult to comment from a residential perspective. Okay, but certainly if you look at what we've done in the enterprise space and business space, we've gone for the high-density areas and we've fibered up as much as we can. For example, the likes of Sandton and Rosebank and those places. Those were early investments that we made. and we're now taking that fiber into buildings. Mm-hmm. So we've identified there's something like 17,000 buildings that are very close to our network, and over a period of time, we will now provide that fiber into those buildings. Now, some of those buildings will be residential blocks. They are high-rise residential blocks on our fiber, and we will connect them. At what point does it make sense for us to move into, for example, gated communities and your traditional residential? I don't really have an answer as of today.
Okay.
It really depends on where the market is. You know, for example, does it make sense for us to put fiber to your home if you're buying a 1 meg ADSL link? Because really what I'm delivering is actually ideally suited for a 100 megabit connection at first.
Okay.
That's the equation.
William, did you want to say something?
Just in terms of population density, South African cities tend to be quite spread out, in addition to cars. Metropolis is a terrible thing. But if you compare us with, for example, the US, overall, we have 25% more people per square kilometer.
Interesting statistic. Jean, it was mentioned a bit earlier, the Australian broadband rollout, left-leaning administration there has decided to spend, I think it's $43 billion rolling out fibre across Australia. Do you think we should be looking at spending taxpayers' money like that in South Africa, or would that be a waste of money?
You know, obviously we come, at Acres, we come from the angle directly to the consumer market. So whereas possibly Neotel and the other gentleman with me, their focus is on for the business, as Matt mentioned, you know, the 100 megabit per second fiber connection. For us, our focus is on the consumer, and a lot has been spoken. I think if you go and you look at, past articles over the past years about when things like local loop and bundling are going to be legislated, and we're going to come to pass when Neotel launched a few years ago, there was a lot of hope in the market. And probably, I believe exactly what Matt said, that fiber will eventually get to every place, but the question is when. And that often becomes the issue that consumers are sitting with when they're sitting at home. And I believe there are many, many quicker solutions to getting cheaper bandwidth to everybody in South Africa than the final in local loop and bundling kind of goal that everybody sets. You know, they're at the moment, if you want a true broadband, let's call it 4 megabit per second ADSL connection to your home, you're going to be paying Telkom around about 540 Rand per month before you've even sent your first email or you've looked at your first website. And for us to say we want to get that kind of broadband into everybody's hands, it's almost impossible for the majority of our population in South Africa due to those initial prices. And those prices are obviously for the actual ADSL library for the 4 megabits per second, but then also the analog call cost that Telkom are charging.
The other challenge, John, is that you can't get ADSL in most of the country. It's only available in certain parts of the metropolitan areas.
Absolutely. But even in those areas, that price point is probably too much.
Mm.
And there are much, in my opinion, much simpler solutions to getting those overall costs down dramatically to the kind of users, to the users that can have access to that.
Okay.
You know?
I want to get to the issue of local loop and bundling a little bit later, but perhaps I could ask Lars to come in here. I suspect I know what the answer is going to be already because you're a mobile operator, but Lars, do you think our future is predominantly wireless in South Africa, or does the country need to invest heavily in fixed lines for broadband, specifically in the access layer?
Well, I guess for me the answer is quite easy. It's wireless. But there's a big but. What people tend to forget that wireless is really the last mile, the last kilometer. Wireless without the, you know, the proper infrastructure behind it, without lots of data pipes, it simply doesn't work. You were able to do the old GSM technology with microwave. You could do quite a lot of things, you know, sort of, you know, you can do a lot more now with digital microwave, but reality is, if you look at the data growth that we can foresee, at least we can see in other countries, and I don't see why it shouldn't happen here. As an example, you know, AT&T has grown their data traffic in the last, I think, 3 years by 6,000%. 6,000% on a mobile network is an absolute horror for any technician. It's a it's a complete no-no. You know, in the old days when GSM came on stream in 94, 95, you had what was called a 6-month build-up rule, where everything looked different. You had to already have deployed 6 months ahead of time. Now, if you think about 6,000% growth in 3 years, you can see why people are not so happy with AT&T service these days. Because, you know, it's extremely hard to build that out. And, you know, if you have an investment committee of shareholders, you say, by the way, guys, we're planning 2,000% growth this year. Actually, with very little revenue increase, they look at you and say, well, you know, what do you want? And we then have to save you one money. So, in other words, you know, unless we have a solid infrastructure in the back that actually supports all this traffic that will come over the air interface, it's going to be very difficult. I think what people underestimate is the, you know, we look at other markets, for example, Hong Kong, or, you know, European markets, where you had the old telcos who had already the, you know, the cable, the copper cable in from, I don't know, the times of the Austrian Emperor. And funny enough, you know, that old copper cable still works quite fine for ADSL. But here we have a situation where Telkom today is actually providing fewer lines in 2010 than at the end of the plan. You know, that's a reality. I know of friends of mine who had an ADSL connection who got a friendly letter saying, due to cable theft, we no longer provide you with ADSL connections. And they had it for 2 years.
Is that because people are going to mobile, or is that an indictment on telecom?
No, that is because say, I don't know what's happening, but, you know, it seems at least that the dominant carrier there has decided to give up, if you want, on deploying any fixed lines, and has decided to, well, if copper goes out of the ground, then it's out of the ground forever. I don't know if that's just in anticipation of 2010, and they were busy building this fantastic fiber network that nobody has yet seen. Nor can we even buy capacity on it. We'll see. I don't know. But reality is in other places around the world, be it Southeast Asia, also be it, you know, be it even very, very developed countries, like, for example, Austria, where I was once had the pleasure of building a mobile operator. The people are moving towards wireless. And the fixed line telephony essentially goes away. Because people like the convenience of just picking up a phone and just dialing the number. You know, I don't dial your phone number. I dial Duncan, and you know, I wouldn't even know. I mean, you know, so occasionally I have to think, what is my phone number? Because it's so convenient with the mobile. And on the other hand, you have people. You know, you have a huge penetration of broadband in, for example, Austria, but you have already 30% of the population have a broadband dongle. Today.
Mm.
So, you know, I think quite naturally the way things are moving, I think it's going to be towards, you know, mobile, with wireless broadband.
Mm.
And yet, behind that wireless broadband is a lot of infrastructure that needs to be put in place.
Mm.
Possibly, you know, I wouldn't say to every house, but, you know, maybe to every street corner.
Derek, perhaps I could ask you to come in here. The message there is very clear that certainly in the access level of the network, the move is away from fixed line connections to wireless. But the real question is, can wireless deliver the broadband applications of the future, like video on demand, high definition video conferencing, the sort of things that people are going to be wanting to be doing a few years from now?
The answer is yes, wireless. I think you're going to need both. And you're going to be both wireless and fixed line, even for the last mile. You know, if you look at the situation that we currently have in South Africa from an economic perspective, on our network we've got about 75,000 mobile data users and about 150,000 DSL users. And the 150,000 DSL users generate roughly 30 times as much traffic as the mobile users. And that's an economic, not a technology. The problem right now is that, you know, with all the, it's not from the last, it's from the people who are represented here, with all the noise about mobile replacing DSL, it still costs roughly 4 times as much to push the traffic over the mobile network as it does over the DSL network. So, you know, unless the economics of the mobile networks keep pace with the technology, I think it's going to be very, very difficult to have that kind of mobile technology replace fixed line. And if you look at what's happening in developed markets, the vast majority of the actual traffic is still traversing fixed last mile. So if you look at what's happening in the Netherlands, if you look at what's happening in all the countries we've mentioned here, Hong Kong, Singapore, etc., although more people are connecting via mobile, if you look at traffic volumes, it's still being generated on fixed access mechanisms. And I think the same trend will continue here. If you look at the European situation, my understanding is that the mobile operators have largely conceded that they've actually underpriced data. So the drive for them is to actually get the data prices up in order to invest in some of the new network technologies, etc. So I don't think that from the mobile operators' sort of economics right now, bringing down the price of mobile data is going to work for them for the next couple of years, no matter what the technology does. And for that reason, I think there still need a significant investment in fixed last-mile technology or alternative-wise last-mile technology. And I think that's also something that is a very important access mechanism. I just want to add to William's sort of analysis of the five factors. If you then look at what makes up the price that end users pay on the DSL, we already heard Gian talk about the 540-odd band for the actual telco link. It's important to understand that then if you look at the amount that you pay your internet service provider, telco at the moment at current pricing levels are taking about another 40% of that through their RPC charges. And that's actually becoming one of the big limiting factors to adoption along with the actual loss model. So unbeknown to many consumers out there, telco is taking a lot more than just the loss model. They're also taking 40% of what all the other internet service providers do through the IPCs.
Can I start you to for the non-technical in the audience, can you just define what an IPC is?
So if you get a DSL circuit, you have to get it from Telecom. It goes through Telecom's network, and if your internet service provider is not Telecom, that internet service provider has to pay Telecom for what's called an IPC. And that IPC is how the traffic gets from the telco network onto the internet service provider's network before it actually breaks out to the internet. So if you look at the price that the end user then gets charged per gigabyte or for a certain type of package, about 40% of that at the moment is still being paid across the telco through that IPC charge.
And as the cost of bandwidth of the packages come down, that percentage goes up.
100%. Because Telecom haven't changed their price in about 18 months. So that price has remained static for 18 months at a time when the national network costs, et cetera, are coming down quite substantially. So I think that's something that's got to be addressed. If you look at the mobile situation, you get a very similar situation, where despite the fact that the mobile operators are passing a lot of the costs for the infrastructure, support, et cetera, onto their resellers, they're continuing to actually increase the costs through various mechanisms, both the actual data charges themselves, as well as mechanisms designed to make it more difficult for people to take direct connects into the mobile operators and handle data traffic on them. So I think there's been a lot of scrutiny which has been cracked from the DOC and from ICASA the last little while into the voice world and interconnect there. While I'd still like to see it come down further, I think we need to have similar scrutiny about exactly how the data world is made up. Because I think there are a couple of elements that are really keeping that price very high at the moment that can drive some pretty short-term results. Because I think as AfriHost and people like AfriHost have demonstrated, the price elasticity of demand is still much higher than that.
Okay.
If you can bring the price down, you can all buy more.
I'd like to come back to that one issue. Cell phone interference or something. I'd like to come back to the whole issue of local loop unbundling and IPC costs, etc. But before we get there, I'd just like to perhaps just come back to talk a little bit more about the wireless issue, and specifically talk about WiMAX. I know a couple of years ago, WiMAX was being touted as this great solution to routing around telecom and service providers could roll out their own networks, etc. But in the last year, WiMAX seems to have gone fairly quiet. Perhaps I could ask Derek, is WiMAX not the great savior we were expecting it to be, and do you think it's going to survive the onslaught from the cellular operators with 3G and later LTE?
I think
if you look at the latest iterations of the WAMEX standards, they're very similar to all these standards. So, from a technology perspective, probably the biggest deciding factor right now is the availability of terminal equipment in various frequency bands. And in that regard, it seems to us that WAMEX still has an advantage for the next 18 to 24 months. It's just much easier for us to get you customer premises routers for fixed line replacements, not for mobile devices, on the WAMEX network than it is to get them on any kind of trial 4G networks or even 3G networks. And the other reason I think WAMEX does have space, I think that that gap is closing very, very, very rapidly. But I think if you look at the spectrum that's available now, the 2.6 gigahertz spectrum, and hopefully even I want to draw you to something you feel uncomfortable about, but hopefully William can give us some indication of when he also intends to issue the final ITA, but it would be extremely useful. like, once the ITA comes out, and my understanding is that ITA is not tied to wireless. So that spectrum could be used for LTE technology as well.
Okay.
I think that the next challenge with that is going to become what the economics are around the procurement of that spectrum. Because there's no doubt in my mind that a business model based on voice and intermittent usage of spectrum allows an operator, particularly an operator that's an incumbent and has an existing network, to squeeze more money out of the spectrum that they have than using that same spectrum for leased line replacement. And it's going to be very important how that spectrum is priced to determine who will use it and for what. Because there is a point where a WiMAX business model, if you see WiMAX as being leased line replacement, falls down, and a mobile operator would probably still buy the same spectrum and say, well, the business model for us to use that spectrum for voice calls actually still works. Of course, that's telling you there's still very high margins in voice calls, but, you know, that's one of the factors that I think is driving that. It's going to be quite important how the regulators use this in South Africa and how the DOC views. Because if it's viewed as something that's open to bidders that have existing voice networks, I think it's just going to be priced at a level where it's not going to be used to drive broadband. But if it's used in a different way, then I think that it might have quite a substantial impact. And I know Jim is referring to that as one of those alternative broadband technologies. I also think of one of the reasons why we want that spectrum for broadband is also to put some pressure on people like Telkom. Mm-hmm. One of the lessons that I've learned over the last couple of years is that it's important to have an alternative because it puts pressure on the incumbents to provide service. You may find that 90% of what you're getting is still DSL, but believe me, people will be more eager to get your DSL service more quickly if there's an alternative that could be installed in a week than what you currently have. And we saw that happening in corporate leased lines.
Oh, yes.
But as soon as wireless became a viable alternative, the service levels and the time that people could provide those services suddenly went up quite dramatically. So it's not only important as an alternative, it's also important as a way of exerting competitive pressure in the market.
William, what is ICASA's current thinking around that specific bandwidth, the 2.6 gigahertz band? What's happening there, and what is ICASA going to be looking for from companies that want to use that spectrum?
I'm not quite sure. The draft documents about 2.6 and 3.5 gigahertz spectrum were submitted to the council committee last week, and the withdrawal was not being looked at.
Why?
Someone wasn't happy with it. So I don't know what the answer is.
Okay.
But just generally on wireless is a great intermediate solution. It's a solution that you can roll out quite quickly, and you can provide connectivity to quite a few people at quite a useless. But you can't provide high bandwidth connectivity to lots of people at the same time. You can't provide connectivity to a very high density of people in a typical city without it suddenly becoming expensive because you suddenly need a whole lot of different stations. And WiMAX in particular, it's a little bit, I think WiMAX is to some extent suffered from being a victim of its own hype. Intel has been the primary driver behind WiMAX, told us that we would have 260 in this laptop by January 2007. It didn't happen. It was the laptop in 2009. It still has to apply my percentage. Either D or E. It takes all of my last laptop. Yes, there are a few laptops with my percentage, I understand, but I haven't actually seen them. There was a lot of noise made about the fact that you can get 70 megabits per second on a WiMAX connection, you can get 70 kilometers on a WiMAX connection. What most people fail to realize is that you can't do both at the same time. So let's say for the sake of argument, you are sitting no more than 100 meters away from your local WiMAX base station, and you're getting a nice, generous 20 meg connection, and your neighbor's also getting a 20 meg connection. And, well, maybe one other reason that the base station flat. To provide those, the three of you, it is actually cheaper to use the system. Whether that's copper or fiber. The WiMAX is a great solution for rural areas where you can get the benefit of the long range. Where it is too expensive on a per-user basis to roll out many kilometers of a fiber for a single customer. So WiMAX is a great solution for those circumstances. It's an intermediate solution for urban areas. It's a solution that you can use until you have the fiber in place.
Matt, you run a WiMAX network. Neotel runs a WiMAX network. But do you concur with William's views? What are your views on WiMAX as an access technology?
Yeah, I think I agree that the end game, certainly what our customers want to see, is fiber. We do use WiMAX very successfully in these smaller capacity things, up to 10 megabits, it looks fine. Beyond that, and if you're looking for a reliable quality of service, it'll give you up to 75% quality of service, it definitely won't give you 100%, that we know. So as a short-term, as you say, as a stopgap, certainly it works very well. I think what WiMAX has failed to secure is a base of stabilization. Kind of the idea that Intel had of the zero CPE going forward.
Mm.
They certainly have failed to secure that. But as a technology agnostic solution, it works very well. Put it point to point, put it in, put your external antenna in, and it delivers almost immediately.
Great. Good. Moving on, I want to come back to the subject and spend a bit of time talking about the whole issue of local loop unbundling, particularly since the price war began in bandwidth in the ADSL market. There's been a lot of calls, including from you, Jean, for the local loop to be unbundled. Can you perhaps just talk to us a little bit about what local loop unbundling actually means and why it's important and how your customers will benefit from it?
Absolutely. At the moment, Telkom are in control of the last mile. In other words, the copper that gets to each user of ADSL, Telkom are in control of that. And in essence, what local loop unbundling is the method of creating the ability for other internet service providers to be able to make use of that last mile of copper from Telkom Exchange to the clients or the users' home. There are a whole bunch of difficulties surrounding this. An ISP would have to be able to rent space within each Telkom Exchange. Telkom say that a lot of the exchanges don't have space at the moment, or they may never have space. And obviously, they also have invested money, as they see it, into their infrastructure. So they are unwilling to easily let that go. So I think there are many potential problems and pitfalls to that. Even if it is regulated, the ISPs are often going to be batting heads potentially with Telkom. I don't believe will necessarily go out of their way to make it as easy as possible for people to get in there and rent that last mile. As I mentioned before, and Derek mentioned that there are much quicker wins. The IPC costs, the monthly rental costs, and the analog part of the line, I believe those should be addressed before the local loop unbundling is addressed. Or should I say, in tandem and in parallel with the local loop unbundling, because that is where the biggest cost savings are going to come. As Derek mentioned, if you look at the total spend of an ADSL person, probably 75% of that spend goes straight to Telkom. There's a reason that Telkom haven't entered the uncapped kind of broadband wars, and that's quite simple, is they're loving it, right? Because all the people are offering uncapped, suddenly the average user is using way more gigs than they ever used to. Before we launched the 29 Rand per gig special, the average ADSL user is sitting around between 2 and 3 gigs per user or per client. Now, with the advent of uncapped, that average has shot up to, you know, well over 10, and actually more, in obviously in a lot of cases. But even when you take the lower users into account, it shot up dramatically, and that speaks of the price elasticity Derek was talking about. And there are ways that we can, like, get that saving far, far quicker, in my opinion, than locally, but bundling it's in essence just an accounting entry from Telkom side, which may or may not be easy, I don't know, probably not, but I think more pressure should be put in on those assets than just locally bundling.
Okay. I was actually going to address this question to you, John, and let me address it to William instead, now that you've raised it. There is often this call for Telkom to charge either a basic line rental, analog line rental, or a broadband line rental, but not both. Is this a fair argument, William?
Yes and no. The Telkom says that they have what they call an access deficit. Essentially, what that means is that they are cross-subsidizing the cost of the access loop from their wholesale business to the tune of 4.3 billion rand. A lot of money. So one can have some sympathy for them from that point of view. On the other hand, the aspects of the local route that one that the customer is paying for, you're paying for the following things. You're paying for the physical copper wire. You're paying for the connection at the end of the main distribution frame in the exchange from that through to the voice network, the PSTN. So you pay for the capability of using voice. Okay. You also are paying for the filter and the connection through to some kind of IP connection. Currently, it's ADSL in this country, so it's going through to DSAN. And so you're paying for the capability of using data. You're not paying for the use of any of those. You haven't got them yet. You're just paying for the capability. Telkom has divided those three things that you're paying for into two charges. The line charge and the ADSL charge. So you are paying two charges for three things. The Telkom argues that the real cost of the copper wire is, and I may be speaking out of turn here, but I believe the figure is somewhere in the vicinity of 300 rand. And that if ICASA was to force them to sell that on a wholesale basis, on a cost basis, that the price they would have to charge would be higher than the retail cost that you're currently charging. So their argument is that before we can do, if we can implement a local loop unbundling, we first have to go through a tariff rebalancing exercise. And I don't know what the implications are.
Well, wasn't Telkom given a monopoly back in the 1990s to do precisely that, to rebalance its tariffs in anticipation of competition? Does this mean Telkom actually did not complete the process of rebalancing that it was supposed to do back in the period of exclusivity?
Telkom was not only given a monopoly, Telkom was given an obligation. And they were given an obligation to roll out 2.5 million new lines. But one of the ways they did that is that when I ordered 2 lines, they installed 32, which I'll give them. But as big as it may, this is 8 years ago, they started the process with 5.1 million lines. They beat their target of rolling out 2.5 million lines, and they rolled out 2.7 million lines. They finished the 5-year period of 5.1 plus 2.7 equals 4.8 million lines. I kid you not. They rolled out 2.7 million lines and ended up a few lines on this island. Yes, the question is why? Okay, and there are two answers to that. One is the whole concept was misguided. The money that was wasted in the average cost of rolling out, supplying connectivity to a mobile user is $300. The average cost of supplying connectivity to a fixed line is $1,000. Okay? Take note. Cell charge, cell costs are 1/3 of fixed line costs. Look at the prices. But in the case of this disease, universal service lines, but we are not government. In the case of these universal service lines, Telkom was doing it in primarily rural areas where it cost them much more, cost them an average of $3,000 per line. For the money they spent, do the sums, the money they spent rolling out those 2.7 million lines at $3,000 each, they could have built 13 sanitary pipes. It was wasted. It was completely wasted. Okay, so the concept was wrong. Secondly, the business model was wrong because instead of recognizing as the cellular operators did quite soon, and Telkom did rather belatedly, that if you install a line, and you charge an installation, if you install a line to Google in his rural transfer, she probably won't make a single call on that phone in her life. But CIPO is going to phone from the office. And Telkom will get a revenue from that. And they didn't take that into account. They didn't listen to the advice that was given by amongst others Kasatu at the hearings on the subject that the average South African family couldn't afford more than £40 a month rental at that time. And they were charging, I think, around about £80. And the result is that of those new lines that were installed, 72% of them were disconnected within 2 years on the answer non-payment alone. Okay? The same applies to the lines that had previously been installed. That's the fundamental reason why the number of lines went down. There were other reasons like line theft, the cable theft, and so on. The fundamental reason is the business model was incorrect. If the business model took into account the fact that you were gaining income from received calls, then might have been successful. The cellular operators have got that with right. You go out and you spend your £5 or whatever it is, you buy yourself a SIM card, you don't make any calls. People call you. The cellular operator is still making a revenue out of the fact that you have a number, even if you never spend any money. So that's the long sad history.
Mm.
We currently have a situation where Telkom has about 4.5 million working phone lines. And I get the impression they're not very keen on keeping them. In the discussions that we had about earlier, do you want me to go and address that first?
Yes, please.
Okay. The interview process started with a directive from the then Minister of Communications in 2007, directing CASA to unbundled the loan loop by 2011, which is next year. So CASA started on that straight away, and they held some workshops in 2008, and then put together some working groups, which all went ahead much better, until somebody worked out that we had to stop the line. And the reason is because a local loop unbundling is primarily a market remedy. And it also didn't at the time have a framework in place for market reviews. CASA has now done that. We now have a framework for market reviews, and that was published in March this year. That's the first reason. The second reason is that local loop unbundling is a specialized form of facilities leasing. And as you, I'm sure, know, the draft facilities leasing regulations were published recently this year as well. So we can't finish local loop unbundling until we have finished market review process done. And facilities leasing, which is almost done, will be done within a month. So once those two things are out of the way, then you can expect the council to get back to the local loop unbundling issue. And the issue really is not one of facilities leasing. We can today, or at least once the facilities leasing regulations are finalized, you can go to Telkom and you can say, I want to rent space in your exchange. I want to rent that phone line to that customer. You can do that. Okay? The facilities leasing regulations make provision for that. What it doesn't make provision for that is the cost of rent. And that's what has to be dealt with. And that's why it has to be a market remedy that we're looking at competitive issues.
It sounds to me as though November 2011 then is not a realistic deadline to do this.
I don't. I'm not going to make any back promises.
And you mentioned the access deficit problem that Telkom is facing. What, obviously, ICASA has to take that into account, I'd imagine. Would you allow them to rebalance that tariff on a once-off basis? And can Telkom actually afford to do that? I mean, aren't they going to lose even more customers if they put up the basic line rental?
Well, can I always have you twice in a row? I don't know.
Good. Perhaps I could ask Derek to come in at this point. Derek, I understand there are a number of different options available nowadays to do local loop unbundling. I understand it doesn't necessarily have to be a really complex process in terms of Telkom allowing internet service providers, for example, to get access to its exchanges. Can you perhaps talk a little bit about how local loop unbundling might work in the South African context? And is it necessarily as complicated, perhaps, as some regulators have made it up to be?
First of all, I do think that it is a complicated issue. Now, I have to say quite cursory examination of it is that local loop unbundling has not been particularly successful in Australia in terms of driving increased demand for broadband services, etc. It has its problems, and I think that, you know, if you take the sort of simplistic view on local loop unbundling, which is let everybody put their own equipment in the local exchanges and connect the physical piece of copper or fiber or whatever it is into that equipment and then take it from that exchange directly onto their network, I think that's highly problematic. It brings with it a lot of issues about physical access to those devices, who's responsible for change management and change control of those devices. I think that a better interim route might just be to pursue a little bit further this whole issue of cost. And I appreciate people need to make a reasonable return on capital. But if we truly understood what these things were costing and what a reasonable return on it is, you could just have a form of economic unbundling where you're actually regulating the price at which that local loop is made available to people, and you're putting some service levels on it. Now, I'm not talking about unreasonable service levels. I'm simply saying that in an area where you already have an exchange, I don't think it's reasonable to have a monopoly and on top of that say that we will provide you with a link 9 to 12 months from now. If you don't have an exchange, well, that could be a different debate. But if you upgrade equipment in an exchange to provide that to somebody who already has a copper circuit seems extreme to me. And so I would favor some kind of almost economic unbundling, where at a wholesale level, internet service providers and frankly whoever else wants to is allowed to sell that local loop at a reasonable margin to the incumbent operator. All we're asking for is transparency. At the moment, you know, as you can see from our RPC conversation, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors about what goes into people's profits. It's not that different from the whole interconnect space in voice. You know, you start to figure out that people make a lot of profit for doing absolutely nothing. You know, just to illustrate, you know, the point John made earlier on RPC. So if we're now using four times as much bandwidth, Telkom's RPC charging model is data volume. Okay, they're making four times as much revenue for doing absolutely nothing. Okay, there's been absolutely no change.
That may not be the same voice, if I may suggest.
Well, you might argue that they have to upgrade the national backbone in order to carry that higher volume. But if the backbone is a fiber optic backbone, presumably that cost is marginal. So I do think that some form of economic unbundling is more urgently required and probably easier to achieve than a type of unbundling where you're going to allow people to put their own equipment and terminate copper and fiber connections onto that equipment. The other form of unbundling that I think is very important, and in my experience with this, is more in the corporate market than what it is in the consumer market, but I would imagine that the same applies to the consumer, is very often it's not just the actual copper or fiber that is owned by Telkom, or for that matter, I have to say, you know, Neotel or, you know, Dark Fiber Africa, where they put it in. It's the conduit in which that runs as well. And there's a great deal of resistance at the moment to allowing people to put additional strands or fiber or copper into that conduit. I can understand why. It brings about a whole lot of change control issues, etc. with it. And, you know, if something breaks while that's happening, who's responsible for fixing it? I would argue that it's not efficient to have multiple people digging up the roads, putting in conduit, and then in the case of fiber, simply blowing that fiber through that conduit to the home. Mm. What you want is some kind of deregulation of the basic conduit, where those conduits, if you want, in a way, are democratized. And anybody who wants to can then blow fiber or copper through that with their own exchange on the pavement. You know, they don't have to have access to the telecom exchange. You know, if you can run something through that conduit into the home, into the building, put your own exchange down, certainly for some dense areas and for some wealthier areas, I think you'll see a very rapid increase in innovation. And you asked earlier what it would take for people to actually make these economic models to put their own fiber, their own copper, their own cable TV, for that matter, into the home. That's certainly one of the biggest costs. In our experience in the corporate space, 80 to 90% of the cost of the conduit and the physical works around getting that conduit through. The actual fiber or copper is a very small part of the expense. And what you do have in South Africa at the moment is a ridiculous situation where one service provider will arrive, dig up the pavement, put the conduit through. The next day, the next service provider arrives, digs up the pavement immediately adjacent to that, puts the conduit through, puts the road